Postgres conference on reconciling and comparing databases that was all about moving chain sets of data from one database to another database without having simple replication. And at the end of that talk, I kind of waved my hands up in the air and said, well, we have issues with rolling out DDL, and I'm figuring them out, and hopefully I can talk about it next year. Well, it's next year. And the truth of the matter is that though I've thought about this a lot, I do have some thoughts. I will present some of the work we've done, but I don't have the grand unified framework that I thought I would have by the end of the year. First off, let me tell the people who didn't come to my talk last year or who don't remember kind of what the basic setup and the basic use case for our installation in Postgres is. We're a hedge fund. We specialize in algorithmic trading of commodity futures and currencies. Currently, we have over $1.8 billion under management. We take daily settlement price models, daily settlement prices from a bunch of different aggregators, Reuters, Bloomberg, CSI. We do all these complicated things to decide which price source we like on a day. Then we run algorithmic trading models using Java and GNU R against those. There's a diagram coming up, but we run algorithmic models against those things using GNU R. We actually don't have a very large Postgres database. It's about 100 gigabytes worth of data. But the trouble that we have is we have production stage and development nodes where what we want to do is get some of the replicated data, that is the price data, which is for us always canonical once we've cleaned it up. But we have to run different algorithmic trading models against that price data to determine whether or not we're going to trade. And obviously, those things are under constant development. So we have a staging server and a development server that have independent schemas that we use to rehearse both our DDL and DML changes. And I think this is a picture, it's not a great picture, of kind of what our setup is. So we have different instances of GNU R running in production stage and development. The production data, which is data that really doesn't change across all the nodes, like what's the price of wheat yesterday, gets replicated via Sloney. And then the stuff that does get changed, the results, the model calculations, or sometimes the parameters for the model calculations, rest in different servers on the stage in DevTree. Last year, I gave a talk about how what we then do is sometimes we need to reconcile data against production stage and development. And we use David Fetter's project DBI to allow us to do cross-database schema queries so that we can figure out chain sets. Okay, so this is sort of explaining, again, the same things that I said to you before. The stage and dev schemas, to make matters worse, aren't complete copies of the production schema. We have, like, I would guess, you know, billions and billions of prices sitting in our price table. We're probably going to horizontally partition that at some point. We don't know. It's not worth our while. We don't really want that table on our stage and testing schema. We really only want it in one place on the databases. On the other hand, we have these output tables like signals and positions that are going to be different in our production instance and our stage instance. And we very rapidly, oftentimes, when we make a model change, want to see what the differences are going to be. So that's why we end up, in some cases, having some things which are only in the main schema, some things which are both in the main schema and the testing or staging schema, and some things that are in all three places. To make matters worse, we can have trigger functions in the production schema that may have to fire on the stage and dev nodes and write to tables in different locations. Now, this is sort of the setup that we came up with about 3 years ago, and at that point it looked brilliant to us. Obviously, there may have been better ways for us to organize it, but this is what we have right now. Plus, we have a continuous development cycle. Plus, if there is a bug and we don't catch it until it goes into production, it can have an immediate financial impact. So sometimes we end up doing speed patches into production when we really shouldn't. The net impact of this, of course, in terms of our database schemas, at least for a while, was the proverbial anti-pattern of the big ball of mud. Let me explain what that means. We had problems reconciling both the data and the DDL. The metadata wasn't getting smoothly promoted from the dev server to the stage and the production. We would have things like indexes, constraints, and functions missing in different schemas, functions getting called with different arguments in different schemas, functions with the same arguments but different bodies in different schemas. Obviously, this was not great. Okay, last year's talk was mostly about how we fixed some of the data differences. By having all three nodes available via DBI link, you can kind of do this crazy query that I did. I kind of talked a lot about last year, which is assuming the same structure on a table foo here and a table foo here, with a primary key that's the same on both. That is, they both have the same schema at that point. You can do one query that tells you, what are my differences? Do I need to insert, update, or delete on this table? That's what we do to reconcile data. And we actually have a custom app that creates SQL chain sets and rollback sets. So I'll obviously put up the stuff for this talk. Wow, you can't really see this. We have a custom application because what ends up happening is as we move data from test to states to production, we don't always do it with a complete move of the table. Sometimes we only want to add a few of the changes that we tested in test for metadata. We say the wheat model is ready to go, but not the corn model or something like that. So we actually need to pull out rows and say, these rows are different, but these are the ones we're going to apply up to stage. Anyway, this was mostly the subject of last year's talk. So I'm going to move on. But does anyone have any questions about what I've said so far? OK. Now I have to just get this thing to go down. OK. In order to clean up the DDL differences, we had a lot of work to do. And basically, first we had to profile what our differences were. That included figuring out how to track changes in the database daily. Because when we started out, we had like essentially three or four developers, any of which could commit DDL changes at any time. And we had no idea what people were doing, especially not in the testing schema, where it was kind of like the wild, wild west. We started using the PGTAP framework to test some of the functions that are DDL changes. And we are moving to automated deployment and rollback scripts of DDL. I'm going to talk about some of the difficulties we found with that. Obviously, the biggest difficulties that you will probably see is that, first off, you're going to need to mix at some points DML with DDL. That is, you create a lookup table. You got to populate that table with data, and then you're going to add a foreign key constraint on another table that's dependent on that lookup table. You're going to have some issues. Then also, in our environment, we have really Sloney running against the production schema only, so we can push DDL changes up all the way from the development server to the staging server without much problems. But once we get to moving it to master and production, there are more issues because of Sloney. Okay, obviously there are a bunch of profile and deployment tools out there. I just want people to know that we're not the only people who've hit this problem. There are commercial products, SQL Compare, DB Solo, Aqua Fold. There's something called another PostgreSQL diff tool. I think there's also a PG diff project. They're all good for looking at basic changes to schemas and saying this index is missing, this index is not. Some of them have a more hefty, Some of them have a more hefty price tag than others. We found that the problem we had was, That's good. I should drop the thing more often. It makes it work better. Okay. We found that none of these were completely right for our use case because, A, they tended to cost too much money, and, B, we couldn't push them out on the web. I think another PostgreSQL diff tool might have worked the best for us. I don't remember, frankly, right now why we didn't use it. So how? First off, what are the base tools that we use to reconcile, to find the differences between our DDL in schemas? If you have two databases and the schema is named the same, I really recommend Greg's script check Postgres. It's used also for a lot of other things. It can tell you the bloat in your database. It can fire off things to Nagios or MRTG. It doesn't completely cover everything. Greg just pushed some patches out this week, as a matter of fact, to make sure that you do index comparisons probably in the same schema. We use that, and then we take the output and we spit it out with a few minor like coding things for our own needs. So we, for example, here we're looking at the public schema on our master and our stage, and we're going, huh, on the table called contract here, we actually look at the Sloney stuff to say, we got a trigger here that's on master that's disabled, that's okay because Sloney has messed with our system catalog. This trigger is active, and we actually can use the stuff to say, wait a second, we got an issue here because the procedure call between the two is slightly different. So if you've got the schemas and they're exactly the same on two nodes, the check Postgres script should basically get you to where you want to go. The trouble with it at the moment is that script doesn't let you override the schema name for the second database. Maybe it's something that can be coded around, I don't know. But at the moment, we weren't able to use it because we were trying to compare the production schema to the dev schema or to the stage schema. Okay. I'm going to go down now and focus on one particular area, which is that even using Greg's script for functions, we needed more information because it spits out at you and it says, you got a different function body, but it doesn't say what the differences in the function body were. And frankly, because of the way we had done things, sometimes we had functions in test which were more current than the ones in prod. Other times, because we had an emergency problem in prod, we had patched production, and we hadn't gone back and updated test because no one cared. So we needed to actually look inside the function bodies. So this is, again, I guess what I'll do is I'll upload this talk. This is a query that is basically stolen from Check Postgres with a few additional wrinkles that you have to go inside of pgproc to get the information you need for functions. If you go to, I think it's called information schema procedures or something, there's not enough information there, especially if you want to find out for a function not just what it does, but whether or not it's a trigger function. You have to do a bunch of joining. So we did that kind of profiling so that we could then basically in a single query get out the information we need, and then using the MD5 sum of the function body, we're able to kind of look very quickly at stage and public and say, okay, I got a function here called autoscheduler, but the MD5 sum hash, the arguments are the same, but the MD5 hash of the body is different, so therefore it's different. This one's missing, this one's identical. And then we went further and said in our particular case that what you can do then is, you know, you have all the stuff in a hash, you're doing it in Perl or whatever else. We got it so that you could print out the function body, and then there's this great Perl module, if you haven't used, called textdiff, that allowed us then to compare the two and see what the differences were. Because basically, at this point, we were in this huge hole, and we needed to go through, like, I think 278 functions and kind of go, where does this one belong? What does this one do? Okay. After we so that's one thing we did. The other thing we started doing was we needed to start getting an idea of what was changing in the database every single day and why. So what we started doing is that each schema is stored in Subversion. Every night what we do is we run an automated Perl job that does a PG dump with just the descriptions. I think we leave out all permissions. I'll talk more about why we do that later on. And we split the output into individual files and then commit the Subversion changes. Now, the one thing that's highly breakable on this one is the output from PG dump is not guaranteed to be the same between version, major versions. So if you're working in a heterogeneous shop with some 8.3 and 8.4, you'll find that your PG dump output from the two looks different. So right now we're basically mostly 8.3, so it's not an issue for us, but we see it coming up. Obviously, when we switch over, we'll try to switch everything over in terms of the Subversion repository to 8.4 during one day or something like that. But what this allows us to do, obviously, is have a static picture of everything. We can kind of go down to our tables and say, well, what changed and what day. Obviously, when we split the output out into individual files, we try to get, it's pretty simple if you use Perl regular expression pattern matching. We also get the comments, the indexes, the triggers, the constraints, all that kind of stuff, and we slam it into the table file so that everything about the table is in one place and all the comments for it in one place. Same thing with views and operators. And this needs to be extended and made more generic if I were to release it to the community, because it doesn't handle domains, it doesn't handle constraint triggers, it doesn't handle a bunch of things that we don't do. But the basic idea of it, which is to take your PG dump, which is fairly easy to parse, and split it up into individual files and stick it in version control, I think is a pretty good one. Let's see. Okay. The one thing that this is obviously doing is it's giving you on any day kind of what the static view of my or your database is, but it's useless in terms of like pushing out changes, because it doesn't actually have the alter DDL changes that you did to get to this point. I should also note that there's a project which I looked at and I found it interesting, but I didn't quite get what I was going to do with it, called postfacto.org, that's trying to do version control of Postgres stuff. You might want to take a look at it. Okay. So I'm going to skip around a little bit more right now. I'm just going to say that what this does is it gives you a good idea of where things are, but it doesn't show you how you're going to push out changes. Before I talk about how we actually push out changes, I'm going to then talk about what we then tried to do to get our functions in line and how to verify that the functions were doing what we wanted to do. We needed to test functions, especially ones that write to table without side effects. And fortunately, David Wheeler has been working for, I think, the last 2 years on PGTAP, which is a testing framework for Postgres. And if you haven't taken a look at it, you really should, because it, frankly, has really saved our butt this year a lot. What we do is we create an empty, in a single transaction using PGTAP, when we want to test a new function, we create an empty schema, we create the mock tables and canned data from fixture files, and we use fixture files to test both using actual production data that we've copied over from CSV files, and also we can do crazy edge cases, which may never happen in production. We require every test script at our company, we have kind of a fixtures file where we kind of have a preamble to set up the conditions the way we want it. And then each individual test usually has a setup file stored in its own directory. Usually before, I'm going to actually skip this and come back to it, because it's kind of, a fixtures file might have like creating a copy of the table, taking it straight from whatever your public scheme, your prediction schema is, then fixing the synthetic key if you have a synthetic key so it doesn't write to the same sequence, then loading the table and then resetting your sequence ID. That's the kind of thing you would do in a fixtures file. And then, oops, a sample test might look like this. Say that I want to test a function called getBrokerTradeFile. Well, what I do is I validate that I've created the function. Function takes these kind of individual arguments. And then after I've loaded in all my canned data, I start just running tests. I say, well, if I have this contract here, which is the output coin contract, what do I expect to come back as the broker IDs? This is what I expect to see. This is the actual thing that's coming out of the function. And if I get a result equals out of the test, it means I've succeeded. So a test might look like this. I might have a sequence of 51 different tests I'm running on getBrokerTradeProfile. And in the middle of all this testing, what I can do is I can go into my mock schema and I can say, well, what happens if I was trading with a brokerage house? In this particular function is trying to figure out when you create a ticket for a contract when they're about to trade it, what brokerage house we're trading with. And there are all these business tables that affect that, like, do we have a business relation with a broker? Is he permissioned to trade this particular instrument? So I can set up the stuff that I know is true for right now, and then I can go, well, what happens if we've traded with this broker all the time and we have an outstanding position, but now the broker's lost permission to trade the contract? What happens in the test? And I can do that. I'm going to go back now and show you how we set this all up, which is that what we actually do every time we create a test is within a single transaction, we create a schema in our database. In our case, because of our weirder way of doing things, we need to run a function which is going to set the search paths appropriately for whatever we're testing, whether we're pretending to test a function in the development environment, the staging environment, or the public environment. If we're testing the function before we've actually deployed it to the server, we can actually load the code in here, and then we can start running the tests. Or we can actually do regression tests nightly on what's actually out there to make sure that no one's done anything. I think I'm going to skip over this slide. It's not that exciting to anybody but us. Okay, so what we're trying to do then is, in the ideal world, on practically every function we have, we want to have a test suite like this so that anytime you push out a new build of a function, it gets validated and that you run this nightly. Okay, now I started drawing a big graph of common DDL changes. And one thing that should be noticed about almost every single one of them, which makes DDL changes a problem, is that you're going to pretty much be blocking out table writes. Even if you're doing something as simple as creating or replacing a function, you may need to flush a cache connection, because the cache connection may have a cached version of the function. It's not going to know what to do. In some cases, obviously, you can have you can let clients read, but they can't write. So I don't really need to go through this slide in great detail. The key thing to take away from this is the one thing that makes DDL changes harder to push out the DML changes is, even on a normal Postgres database, you kind of have to be ready to lock out or have your database in a fairly quiet state for the stuff that you're changing. Usually involves locking out writes. It may involve recycling database connections. Obviously, the other difference between making a DDL change and a data change is it can be harder to roll back. It's harder to validate and test. And the last thing, of course, is it may require updating or adding role permissions. I'm not going to actually talk that much in this talk about managing your permissions. That becomes a whole nother kettle of fish with this stuff. I'll talk briefly at the end on how we're resolving it. What we're currently doing at the moment is we're creating DDL scripts with rollback scripts. Let's see, how am I going to explain this exactly? Going back all the way over here, sorry. Yeah, over here we have an empty directory here called DDL changes. What we actually do is, in that DDL change directory, if a developer knows he's going to be putting out a DDL change today, he creates a DDL file with all the actions he's going to do, and we want him also to create a rollback script at the same time. And what we try to do is we're building a framework right now so that we set permissions on the user that's applying the DDL changes so the script can't write into the appropriate schema. Okay, what we do is, when we try to push out a DDL schema and to test, we want to make sure that in our cockamamie environment, we can have a situation where if a developer makes a mistake, we don't want him to write on the testing server into the public schema by accident. And as you know, the trouble with DDL changes is it's easiest to do them if you're the owner of the object that you're doing or you're a super user. In this case, what we want to make sure of is the person who's doing the DDL change can write to, for example, the development schema, but not the public schema. So what we do to make sure everything's okay is, first off, we have roles for each schema which are updated automatically daily. Like, we have a script that goes through and says, what's every object in test? What's every object in our development schema? Give the permissions to the dev writer that he can write to that schema, and then also give only select or read permissions to the dev reader. And we have these kind of 5 or 6 generic roles. Then at the start of a DDL application, we create a temp user with the appropriate permissions. We have a script that parses through the DDL file to see what objects this guy has to take ownership of, so that he can change the stuff, and then at the end we drop the temp user. And the reason why we go through all these conniption fits is, essentially, imagine that you have a function called imagine you have a function called run market in both your development schema and your public schema. And the developer makes a mistake, and he updates the function in development, but he updates it with the signature of the one that exists in the production node. If you're not careful, if you don't have the right permissions, he can overwrite the function in the public node because he'll say, you know, create a replace function, blah. So you have to make sure that the permissions are set up in this our particular use case with only the schema that you want to write to. Okay, so here's an example DDL interaction. There's a DDL script with mixed DML in it. You're going to create a table called MyLookup. You copy it from an original data file. Then the table that's dependent on, you're going to add an integer. Then you're going to update the lookup integer. Then you're going to set it not null. Then you're going to add a foreign key. The rollback is going to obviously drop the lookup column from the table and drop the lookup stuff. Before it gets started, what happens is we parse this stuff and we create an ownership script that creates the temp user, then alters the table, my table, to set the owner to the DDL plier, and then it reassigns the owner to the owned by this guy, and then it drops the temp user. That seems to be off my slide. So what we do is, here's an example of how we work it. We're beginning to build this framework right now. We have a script called apply DDL changes. It looks at the SVN for the DDL changes directory. It grabs the files from there. And first, what it does is you can simulate it. It does a test apply and then a test rollback. In this case, this particular test thing, what did it do? Oh, it created or replaced a view called TS summary, and then it rolled back the code to the previous version. And we say, okay, we have a good script here. We both have a good script to apply a DDL change and a good one to roll back. Okay. The trouble that we have with this is, of course, we can have different kinds of chain sets happening at the same time. Yeah. I think what we wanted to do was we have to audit every single day what permissions users have on the box and why. And so what we wanted to do was we wanted to temporarily assign user permissions just for the sake of the DDL, and we wanted it to go away. And that's why we did it that way. Okay. There are promotion complexities. Obviously, not every DDL chain set can be applied at the same time. How do you push some up and omit others? Right now, what we're doing, which is perhaps a neo-primitive way of doing this, is in our DDL change directory, we simply name the chain sets with it's the ISO date, and then a number, and then a description, and the same ISO date and number with the rollback. And what we do is we have a file in the directory that says last file applied. And if a developer says, I don't want to apply this chain set today, he's responsible for using SVN move or remove to either push the chain set out into the future or delete it or block it. And what we're trying to do right now and what we're doing at the moment is in our development tree, we apply chain sets automatically every night. And if it fails, it just doesn't get applied, and then the developer has to go back and fix it. So our complete chronology of events now, actually in our dev cycle, is that we have three different processes that run. The first one goes out, checks out the SVN, gets the DDL changes, runs all the scripts. Then a second process goes, gets the PG dump for the schema, and takes the static snapshot of the schema at that point in time. So that you have at any moment, you can do two things. You can say, when was the last time that run market was touched? Let me look. Okay, it was touched in February and we added a field. At the same time, you can also say, what were the last six changes that I did in the database using DDL? And you can play them back or roll them back. Now, roll back on DDL, I have to be honest with you and say that I think it's mostly theoretical. That is, if you add a new column, or if you drop a column from a database as part of your thing, obviously if on that day you want to roll it back, you can get the data that you dropped out. But say it's 2 weeks later, and you decide that you want to roll back and put that column in. Well, obviously, probably your rollback isn't going to really work. It's nice to have it there. It can save your butt if you made a mistake and you immediately want to go backwards in time. But I think past more than a day or so, rollback is mostly theoretical. Okay. This is only going to work for you if you have a unitary pipeline for your DDL changes. The moment that you have more than one way to do this, this is just not going to work. The other thing is, it's very fine for me to say that, you know, we simulate the DDL change. And usually we can get away with doing this. We're in a test schema, we alter the table, and in a single transaction, we roll back the alteration. But if you've got a big change to a huge table with billions of records, it's obviously going to be very costly to simulate. So we're thinking about whether or not we do the same thing that we do with some of our PG tap tests, and we copy an empty structure of the table into another schema and then do all the changes there. And the last big bugaboo on this one is replication, especially Sloney 1.2 replication. Okay, the problem we have with DDL replication is that Sloney 1.2 in production requires a global lock on every table in the replication stat before public DDL changes. And the same also applies if you add or subtract a table in a different, or sorry, if you make a change to a foreign key constraint in a table in a different schema that references a table in the Sloney cluster. And I'm sure the Sloney guys can explain this better than I can, but basically it's because Sloney messes with the system catalog for triggers in 1.2, because at the time 1.2 was written, there was no other way to disable triggers.
Well, it's really very simply that it doesn't alter table. The process of turning, execute script starts by taking the triggers off so that you can run unchanged. You do your execute script, which does whatever it will,
right,
without the triggers, and then we add the triggers back. So it's
right. Right.
We remove them, you do your work, we add them back.
Right.
Those 2 points in time require having an exclusive lock on the table.
Right.
Since it's all done in one transaction, this is, once you've got the one lock, you've got the one that you need to add them back. So,
right.
It's heavy.
Yeah.
Heavyweight.
Okay. So the basic problem that you therefore have is if you've got, even on your test or state, in our case, even in our dev or stage instance, if we want to change a foreign key constraint that references the table in the Sloney cluster, or when we push stuff out to production, we actually have to do things in a very different manner because DDL changes have to be applied knowing that you need a global lock on every table. Now, once Sloney 2 is out there, this will not be an issue because it disables triggers by just saying alter table, disable trigger, and there's no messing with the system catalog. So then you're only going to need exclusive locks on the table that you're actually changing. Right. Right.
Or when you first added it to replication.
Right.
It never needs to do that again.
Anyway, so we'll all be happier, all of us, I'm sure even the Sloney team will be happier once we've checked out 2.0 and it passes all its regression tests. Okay, so this is where actually my talk is basically going to stop. I could show you how we push out changes to production, but we're still debugging it, which is basically we have to, now, on the slave nodes and everybody else, we have to do a big global lock, so we lock all the tables to say whether we've got them locked. Once we know that we can lock all the tables, we release the lock, then we execute the DDL script on the master node, then we wait for replies from all our slave nodes, but it's not very pretty code yet. So I'm just going to talk about possible directions that we're thinking about going with this kind of stuff in our company. One, we hope that we can enforce the enforcement of test suite success before promotion. That is, right now, we have this whole process where we go through and when the developer is deploying a function, he passes a PG tap test But then we don't actually run those tests again when we actually deploy the function out. And if we push it up again, we don't check it again when we deploy it out again. So we want to integrate the test suite into our rollout process. The other thing is, it's a drag to make a rollback script for DDL changes if you're promoting functions, because you're going, wait a second, I already wrote this. Why do I have to paste it into another function? So we're going to try to integrate what we have in our SVN snapshot of what is in there to automatically create the rollbacks. Obviously, if, as everybody else was saying at the replication conference, there are DDL triggers in Postgres 9.1 that would help us. All this stuff is userland tools for Postgres. If someone else has written something that's better for this kind of promotion, I would love to hear about it. Peter Eisenstrat, 2 days ago, talked about maybe or not, maybe it would be good for DDL changes to have some sort of package management system. I don't know if any of you saw his blog post, but I thought it was sort of interesting, so I thought I'd sort of put it up there for people to read. He basically is saying, and I agree with him on this one, that we have kind of automated ways of pushing code up from dev to state to production, and the same issue hasn't really been thought out in the database community in the same way. He's confident that he can do it with some kind of a package management system that's kind of like the Debian package management system, but I'm not quite sure I understand how. And then last but not least, I suppose if you don't like that, you can always find that there are lovely products for other databases that claim to do this kind of stuff without any issues at all. I haven't tried them because I can't afford the Oracle license. And that's basically where I am in the talk. I was kind of hoping also that some of you might have comments or thoughts about how you actually push the DDL changes out, whether or not the way that we're trying to do it at my company makes sense, those kinds of thoughts. And that's where I am at. So are there any questions, any criticisms? And needless to say, like everybody else here, we're hiring, so if you're interested in working to help build this DDL framework at my company, I would be very happy to talk to you. Yes?
I was very interested by that notion of having the regression test that includes testing the rollback strategy.
Yeah. Well, so far we haven't pushed the... usually what we try to do is usually you don't like to do the big bang DDL change. You try to do like one table at a time or something like that. So what I can say is, as long as you're not doing anything more extensive than, you know, adding one foreign key constraint or adding a few fields to a table, the rollback is very simple and the whole thing takes about, you know, 3 seconds to do. It's if you end up having to do like a huge swath of stuff at the same time, you might run into trouble with this one. We just want to know that the developers thought, in a way, a lot of times with a rollback, I think it's just an exercise to make sure the developers thought through every single thing that can go wrong. If they've got it so they can cleanly apply both the script and the rollback, then you're in pretty good shape, usually, to deploy. Wow. Any other questions, comments? Yes.
I was curious if you tried SQL Translator when you were listing units and listed among the other tools.
No, I haven't. Is it a Java-based tool? What is it?
No, it's part of the SQL Theory project.
Okay.
Perl, and I got fairly good results with it. I had to extend it somewhat in order to get it to work usably for Postgres, and it still doesn't have complete support.
Okay.
The project seems a little bit stalled, but it's pretty far advanced.
So does it compare, like, databases, or what does it do? Okay. Well, I should take a look at it then. We've also, by the way, for graphing on stuff, if you want to look at stuff, I have to say that Schema Spy, if you haven't looked at it, is really... Okay. SQL Fairy, I know, for the graphing side of it. That's very good. But Schema Spy is even cooler because, at least for me, because you can drill down into your tables in a schema and see the relations only for a small amount as opposed to having a huge diagram where you can't keep track of anything.
Okay.
Subset of it
that's relevant for this.
Okay. how are other people deploying DDL at their company, or does it? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
We have a similar thing at Etsy where we do that. That's nice. We know how quickly what's changed. But one deal is that each account seems to mangle certain things, like views. It expands it out, presses it, and it's really hard to deal with complex views. So we tend to keep aside thing of source code.
Yeah, I mean, we've noticed this too. Someone was saying to me that the thing they hated with PG dump is when you do. Not that I would do this. Maybe it was Jim Nasby. When you do, he has a view where you go select star from blankety blank, and then when you do it in PG dump, it actually writes out all the fields, and then also it's really ugly output out of there. I looked at it and kind of said, well, maybe I would have some sort of post-processing of this stuff to fix the views. I mean, in practice, actually, what we also do at the moment, I mean, we're still smoothing this whole process out. We actually have, besides the production stage and dev, we have, you're right, we have a working source code directory so that the developer, before he's ready to even apply it to any of the things, has a place to save his changes, and you can put the view in there in a nice way. But it's true, the view output is not so readable out of PG dump. So.
I know Andrew tried to fix that, but he got a lot of pushback.
Really?
It
would be nice for us.
Yeah. Well, I think that the problem is that the functions when the views look fine, if you load them in with T-SQL or whatever, they're fine.
Right.
But then if you reload the schema, like we do often, then all of a sudden you get this mangled view definition back in there. It still works just fine. The logic's there.
Right.
But then you go to compare, and then it's just, I wish someone would fix it.
Yeah. The other thing that's really tricky, actually, in all this stuff is that I think that really the best way to do all this, even with the DDL stuff and everything else, is actually to have a full regression test against all your functions every single night after you do this. Because functions, I don't know if anybody notices this, but there are hidden dependencies with functions. You can have a function call another function, and those dependencies aren't tracked by Postgres. So you have a function create function foo that calls function bar, and then function bar gets dropped, and the next time you try to run function foo, it just won't work because, you know, I think it's outside. It's more difficult for them to figure out that dependency. So in the ideal world, what we really want to do is, again, plugging David Wheeler's project, you have a very nice script that kind of automatically goes through and creates PG tap tests for just the existence of objects. You need to, it doesn't work? I haven't tried it recently.
It was just something I hacked together. I didn't mean to distribute it with PGTab. It should be its own separate thing.
Okay, well, shoot. I was about to say we should all use this, but I guess if it's not.
No, it's on GitHub. Go ahead.
Okay. Okay. Because, you know, it's ideally what you want to do if you're doing a full-blown thing of this one and you're being very paranoid, and believe me, it pays to be paranoid on this stuff. Is you run your test, you do your DDL changes, then you run your test against the functions you change to make sure they do what they do, and then you do a full-blown regression against all the objects in your database to make sure all the others still work. That's really the way to do it.
I've had on my to-do list to do something like that to test PG Migrator, now PG Upgrade.
Yeah.
Maybe someday I'll get to that, and then there might be a tool for that.
Okay.
Right. Don't forget to run your test before so you know that the failure happens due to your...
Yes. No, that's a good point, too. Yes?
Do you have any dynamic SQL in your Sprock, or is it all made?
Do I have dynamic SQL in the procs that I do for this kind of stuff?
No, in your schema at all.
Pretty much no, because we didn't like the speed, and it's also hard for us to know what it does in most cases.
Right.
So, okay. Anything else from anybody? How does it? Just out of curiosity, how are other people promoting DDL changes, or... Does everyone do the ad hoc thing that we were doing until then? Yeah. Right. Then you put it on your production. Yeah.
We have some very ugly scripts that are used to apply patches and some meta
So then you apply the patches incrementally up.
The patches that haven't been applied yet.
Does it work?
Most of the time. There are some issues, and we really need to fix it up or get somebody to fix it up for us. But it's a lot better than doing it by hand.
Yeah. Well, I think that's basically all I have to say, which is that the one thing that I think is interesting about this whole area is that as Postgres moves out and becomes a more solid product, first we were concerned about replication issues. Now we're concerned with kind of these interesting edge cases, and testing, deployment, pushing stuff up is sort of the area that I'm seeing a lot of activity these days. The USULAN tools need to be, I think, worked on now. All right. Greg, we're done.